Good evening, I'm Derek, I'm an alcoholic. Derek. Nice to be here this evening, thank you. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. Thank you, God. Or should I sign it? Thank you, God. It's for one sign, I know. And it's good to see everyone here tonight. Thank you, Jill, for asking me to speak. Truly an honor. Honored to be here, and it's anytime I'm asked to speak at or get a chance to address an AA meeting, it is always an honor, and it's not something I do often. Not a circuit speaker per se, but I am an alcoholic, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in Boston, as you can tell my accent a little bit, on the East Coast side. I'm sober today, and sober is much better. And my good friend Donnie from Hyde Park, Massachusetts, would always begin his talk with that. He would say, sober's better. And for me today, sober's better than drunk any day of the week. It was good to hear Daniel. Hide your keys. Definitely hide your keys. No, it was great to hear him, and I've seen him come a long way, and he's actually worked on my car. He's a good mechanic, not to plug him any, but he's done good work in and out of AA. And I'd just like to also take a moment to thank the guys that support me, that came to hear me speak tonight, some of my friends, some of my new AA friends in San Diego, guys that have helped me and that I've gotten a chance to know. And love, I guess. So thank you, guys. And I came to San Diego a little over 6 years ago to get sober. I've been in AA, in and around AA, since 1986. So that's 30 years in AA. Came to AA at age 16. So I've been around here a while, and I've heard and been to a lot of meetings, and I've heard a lot of the message, 30 years of message. And the message has always been the same, I think, from my very first AA meeting. The message was, if you're an alcoholic, there is a way out, there is a solution. Whether you're ready to hear that solution or not, really just depends on how much you've suffered. You know what I mean? Like, my primary purpose tonight here is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And I know there's a lot of new people here. And the message I hope to give, or I hope to bring, is that God will solve all your problems if you can get in touch with Him. I don't know. I'll tell a little bit about my story. I don't want to get into a real big drunkalogue, but I will identify myself and qualify as an alcoholic here tonight. Come from a family of five, mother, father, two brothers. Grew up in and around Boston, in the city, and in a small suburb called Quincy. But most of my upbringing was in two towns, Dorchester and South Boston. And that's where I learned of alcohol, and I learned of the way of life of the alcoholic. Both my parents were very heavy drinkers. My mother was a bartender, and my father was a truck driver. Drunkenly trying to attend law school at night. Their marriage did not work out, and they divorced when I was about four. And I was just thinking, seeing the hearing impaired here tonight, I was actually deaf as a kid. As a young boy, I could not hear. So growing up, the first two or three years of my life, I could not hear. And I really didn't think about that till I saw this woman signing. So my older brother used to do my talking for me. Do you guys want cookies? Derek, do you want a cookie? And my brother Rob would always answer for me. Kind of funny what you think about when you come to an AA meeting. You never know what you're going to hear around here. You never know what you're going to think about. And for me, that's been my experience and journey. You never know when you're going to hear somebody tell your story or touch you in a way that may enable you to, you know, say, wow. Light bulb going off. But anyway, my parents divorced and we moved to the projects when I was about, I don't know, four and a half or five. And my mother tried to raise three boys on her own, so that was difficult. And she, you know, she would leave us alone many times to go work in a bar in Boston, in a place called Chinatown, much like your Chinatown here in San Diego. They don't have as big a Chinatown as they do in Boston or New York, but she worked in Chinatown bartending, and no babysitting money, so the boys, my brothers and I, were left alone, and that fear of where's mom, you know, was always prevalent. She met a guy who moved in with us, and he was a John Belushi, Jim Morrison type of guy, really wild and crazy, and sold drugs for a living. So we, you know, were inundated with that lifestyle for a few years. And I and my mother was very kind of a hippie, kind of a Boston hippie. So my house became almost like a pot smoking commune, one of those little communes. And I had permission to smoke pot as a young boy, 6 and 7 years old. I smoked pot in my house with my parent, with my mother and her boyfriend. And, you know, I had access to a lot of things as a kid that a kid probably shouldn't have access to, drugs and money and booze. I mixed drinks. I was a bartender. Eventually, we moved out of that project, and we moved into a nice house because they had plenty of cash. And that's where my story, my alcoholism, really began. Seeing alcohol on a daily basis and being around it. I loved everything about people who drank. I loved the drinking personalities, and I think I always gravitated to people that drank. Eventually, my father's father moved in with us, my grandfather. It was a little strange, I know, for my dad to have his father living with his ex-wife and her boyfriend and two sons. That was a real sore spot in his life. And my grandfather, I would watch him drink probably a half gallon of vodka every day. And he taught me many things. And he brought me around the bar room. And I tagged along with him a lot. I really loved my grandfather. At age 12, right around the time I was getting ready to have my first drink, he died in the bedroom next to mine. He had an alcoholic episode. He was drunk, and he threw up, and he choked on his own vomit. And my older brother, Rob, went in and found him, and then, you know, we ended up putting him in the ground. And that was about a month and a half before I would have my first drink. My first drink consisted of stealing $40 off my mother's boyfriend and buying two cases of Michelob beer bottles, and I drank as many beers as I could drink. At the time, I was hanging around with mostly older kids. By this time, I was hanging around with mostly 20-year-old kids because I had access to money and pot. I think my house was, and I used to think about this when I got to California, it was kind of like a medical marijuana facility. We always had at least 20 pounds of pot, you know, around the house, and I was a young kid, and I would walk around with a half ounce of pot on me at all times as a young boy. So getting the neighborhood stoned was, you know, something that I did a lot before I picked up my first drink. So the older kids really adored me, and I was popular, and I felt like a part of something. And I think that gave me a little fuel or a little sense of belonging. But I think when I picked up my first drink, something happened. You know, unlike, you know, being Cheech and Chong and smoking a lot of pot, I think when I experienced alcohol for the first time, something happened in me, whether it was bodily or spiritually or mentally. I just loved the taste. I loved the effect. I loved the feeling, the ritual. I loved everything about booze. I loved just everything about it. I got drunk. I drank 7 Michelobes and threw up, got sick. I don't really remember what happened after that, but I could not wait to do it again. I could not wait to experience that. The book talks about that sense of ease and that comfort that you get when you take a few drinks. And over the course of the next few months, I got in a lot of trouble. I became a teenage runaway, on the streets a little bit, kind of just disappearing. Something happened. I just kind of went wild. And I was kind of wild anyway, but I think alcohol, and I was a little more wild. And I just very defiant, very, very rebellious as a kid. Kind of self-sufficient, because I was left alone to kind of make a lot of my own decisions as a kid with not a lot of supervision. And when I think back, like, when anyone would try to rein me in or reel me in, I was not receptive to that, you know. And I don't know. My teenage years were just a blur, you know. I in and out of the house, in and out of foster homes. Eventually, my parents shipped me off to some foster homes, and I became a ward of the state. I started getting arrested. I caused a fire as a result of my drinking somebody's house that I was staying at. I accidentally fell asleep and ended up setting their house on fire. So, I mean, I was starting to accumulate all these jackpots, as I like to call them, and it was just one after the other. My first time driving, I had stolen a school bus, you know, for a 14-year-old kid. Not really going to driver's ed. You know, driving a school bus is probably not a normal way to learn how to drive, but I didn't crash it, so I was grateful that I didn't get caught. But, you know, I was doing a lot of illegal, juvenile, delinquent type of stuff as a teenager that kind of wound me up eventually getting in a lot of trouble. And I also stole a handicapped person's car. I did get caught for that because I was passed out and fell asleep drunk, and the cops knocked on the window. So I you know, that was my first real brush with the police. You know, having to face that person in court, you know, and just the shame and the disgust from my parents, who were kind of in and out of my life at that time. But they could see, and I couldn't see, but I think everyone else could see what was going on and that I had a problem. The judge told me, okay, you're going to go away, and I ended up going to juvenile detention, and I was committed to DYS, which is your equivalent of whatever youth service, you know, detention you have here in San Diego. But I went away for a little while and tried to right my ship, so to speak. But, you know, as soon as I was released from that, you know, I instantly sought out alcohol again. And I would always seek out booze to kind of, I don't know, to kind of help me to again, quiet that pain or void or whatever I felt was missing. You know, I can't stand here tonight and say, you know, that I had bad times. Every time I drank, it was a cluster. But I can safely say eventually it was like just a slow decay into what this disease truly is, and it's a malady. And Daniel talked about this disease being, you know, a malady, and I was maladjusted. You know, there was something wrong with me, and I didn't know what it was. Even at the time, and I didn't know what was really wrong with me for many years, even in AA, being around here. My first experience coming to AA, I was 16. My father got sober on his birthday in July of 1986. He checked into detox on his birthday, and he went to a place called the Doctor's Hospital in Worcester. And about a month later, he brought me to my first AA meeting on a Sunday morning. And I think about that, and I probably owe him some form of spiritual repayment. I could probably never give back to him, but he gave me the introduction to AA and the introduction to hearing about me, which is what I did those first few months. I heard other alcoholics get up here like I'm speaking now and telling stories and experiences with alcohol. And I related to some, but again, I thought I was too young. I didn't think I had all the issues. Didn't experience all the losses. Drunk driving, marriage loss, divorce, separation, all the things that I had heard. Because at that time in the 80s, it was just, we were just starting to get the influx of young people in AA. And at that time, it was, you know, it was cool to be sober, and I kind of grasped onto that and started running with the young people in AA in Boston. And I got sober. Didn't stay sober because I didn't really apply any of the things that people would tell me to do, because I think I was still self-reliant and defiant to my core. But I think it took a few, you know, doses of, you know, pain and what happens to you when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you get a little bit of sobriety and then you lose it. My story is 24 years of in and out of AA with no recovery before I came to San Diego. And I've had varying lengths of sobriety. My first attempt after my father got sober, I stayed sober, and he stuck me into a treatment center, and I stayed sober for 10 months, and then I relapsed for about 7 months. 19, fast forward, got sober at a country club in a place close to Plymouth, Massachusetts, where this country was founded. Little history, but that's where I got sober, and you know that place. I got a water, thank you. That place sobered me up, and I think I had a desire, and I think I was in enough pain, and I had a little bit of desperation to want to finally listen to somebody, and I did. I listened, and I took some of those suggestions, not all. Believe me, I wasn't going to do everything. I wasn't ready to commit, and when I heard the word God, it was definitely a turnoff. I definitely did not believe in anything higher when I first got here. I was Catholic and went to a few CCD classes as a kid, but for me as a kid or even as an adult now, and when I first came to AA, my concept of God was, I think what I heard somebody say was the adult version of Santa Claus. You know what I mean? Like something that's just made up. And, you know, I didn't buy into Santa Claus. You know, and the concept of trying to tap into something that was unknown to me was so far from what I was willing to do. And I was not ready to even cross that bridge. So to speak. But again, I stayed sober through my 20s. I didn't have a drink or take any drugs. I didn't smoke any pot. I was completely sober and abstinent. But around the time I hit my early 30s, I started to question whether I was an alcoholic, and I started to not feel as I felt like something was missing, and maybe it was a drink that was missing. I kind of knew I had a drug problem, but I did not really think I was an alcoholic. I doubted. I had doubts. And there might be somebody here tonight that doubts the fact or might be having some reservations. And again, that's normal. For me, it was normal in my early 30s. I was going to meetings every day, and you hear around here, you stop going to meetings, you stop praying or doing the deal, as Daniel mentioned, and you get away from AA, it's real easy to pick up a drink. But for me, I think it was a little bit different. I drank over resentment. I lost face, and somebody kind of humiliated me. And a coworker, a guy that had power over me, a boss. And that's what got me drunk, you know, having some as they say, resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. And that kind of got me back drinking. And from there, from, you know, I'm picking up a drink for over 12 years and then actively drinking again, my, you know, they say it, and I don't know if it's true, but it might be. It was like I had never stopped, or I was even worse than when I had left off at 19. I was really bad in those first few months after drinking. It got pretty bad pretty quick. Drunk in bar rooms every night. Inundated with really bad people. Ending up in crack houses and with really strange and unusual places I would end up on a nightly basis. All centered around just that life, again, being inundated with that lifestyle as an alcoholic. And it felt normal, and I could tell, you know, and I would occasionally bump into somebody that was sober in my past, and they would ask me, how you doing? And I'd be like, great, everything's great, having fun, and, you know, telling maybe something funny that happened or something crazy. And Daniel mentioned, you know, Jekyll and Hyde, you know, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and that's what it was. When I'm drinking and I have it in me, I am a completely different person. I am not, I don't think the same way, and I definitely don't act the same way. And anything goes. Anything goes. All. Everything. More. That led to me committing suicide one night, wanting to finally get into that state where I didn't want to live. And that happened, I'd say, mid-30s, 34, 35 years old, and it was over a woman in AA, which was kind of crazy, but that's another long story that I won't get into tonight, but I will say I met somebody in AA. I had sobered up, sober about 3 or 4 months, and I got involved in a relationship in AA and got a woman pregnant in AA. And that was a very, very rough period. My first year of sobriety, coming back into AA, and then drinking after that, shortly after. And that was a tough place. And I finally, like, looking at over the whole body of my alcoholic, experience in and out of AA, I can say, I've made a lot of mistakes, probably every one that you can make around here. Not really trusting and relying on the 12 steps, not believing in them. There's 200 words on that little banner, and they all, I think, have a purpose around here. The principles are in each and every step. I know when they started AA, there was 6, you know, steps. And they kind of cut them in half and came up with 12. And I think over the course of the last 6 years, when I finally made my way out to San Diego and kind of was introduced to the big book and the way of life that is practiced here, and I can't even say, you know, coming here as a stranger, you know, from the other side of the, you know, of this country, I think you can't, you know, you can't get any further away from Boston than San Diego, and I truly wanted to get the frig out of Boston. But to come in here was a beautiful thing, and it was probably the best decision I ever made in my life. I met a guy, I actually got a chance to hear him speak at the recovery home that I got sober at, and I'd met this guy about a month after I came here, and I was homeless in San Diego when I first got here, kind of in and out of sober living, but still kind of sleeping in my truck. And I met a guy that took the time to, you know, talk to me outside of an AA meeting in Lemon Grove. And his, you know, he was patient and he listened to me tell a little bit about my tale of woe, and he gave me a little direction, and, you know, it kind of stuck in me. It kind of I don't know, it kind of resonated. Like he said, I got sober at this place called Pathfinders, and if you're looking to get into a place and get into recovery, this might be the place to go. I was walking around North Park, and I came out of a library, and I saw the sign Pathfinders, and it was their corporate office. And I walked in, and I spoke to the guy in charge, and he directed me down to a little house on Cedar Street. And that's where my journey started, a little over 6 years ago. And I can't even pay enough spiritual homage to that house and to the guys that went through it, and also to that man that took the time out to speak to an alcoholic that he didn't know, and gave me the gift of a little bit of direction. I went through that house. I had a truck. I had a Dodge Ram, silver 2500. But I was very late on the car payments, probably a year behind. And one morning, we have a little meditation meeting that starts the day at that house, and they repoed. They came, and the repo men finally found me and repossessed my truck while the meeting was going on. And, you know, that was probably the most humbling thing that had ever happened to me. It was finally I had nothing. And I finally had to, you know, finally admit that I was powerless. I'm definitely powerless over alcohol. My life at that point was completely unmanageable. Funny thing I heard somebody say, you know, and I wished I took this advice when I met that woman in AA in Boston. And I tell some guys this as kind of a joke, and I guess I'll share it tonight. If you're thinking about getting in a relationship in AA, and you're in a recovery home, I suggest you reveal that I'm Derek, I'm an alcoholic, or I'm Jody, and I'm an alcoholic, and my life is completely unmanageable, and I'm in a recovery home, and I'm homeless, and I'm shot out. And I want to share that with you. So if you're looking around, you know what I mean? Be careful. Be careful. Our 12 and 12 mentions that again, and I don't want to get into that whole Pandora's box, but it says boy meets girl on AA campus and something along those lines. And for me, it was boy meets two girls on AA campus. Because I met a woman in AA that had long-term sobriety, and I married her while my ex was pregnant. So I can't even tell you, you know, what happened in the last 11 years have been like in that situation. But I will say I came to San Diego in that state with all those problems, separated. I had been married for a few years, and I was separated and kind of hiding out, but still looking for an answer. And I found it here. Step one is I'm powerless, and I need to find a power in which to live. And our literature talks again and again and again about this power, which is God. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I stand here tonight truthfully restored to sanity. My life has been restored. Thank you, God. Or sign language. Thank you, God. Lack of power was our dilemma. And I heard a guy say, get in touch with the power and lack of dilemma becomes the power. And that's true for me today. I don't have a lot of dilemmas. My alcoholic problem was removed when I finally asked God to remove it. The two greatest gifts that I've gotten from the 12 steps was the obsession to drink was removed, and I was restored to sanity, a normal way of life. Being alcoholic, that was very foreign, and it's a lot of learning curves have come with that. I took a third step with a man named Ken, and we got on our knees and said the prayer, which is the third step prayer that's located in the big book. And he asked me if I was ready to do the steps, and I was. And we did a lot of work. He showed me how he wrote his fourth step, and that was difficult, and it took me a long time to do it. But I definitely made a searching and fearless inventory. I did not leave anything out. I did not leave any alcoholic stone unturned. I looked at all areas of my life with regards to my resentments and my fears and my sex conduct. Step four was definitely the principle surrounding step four was all about honesty with me. And I was able to find some honesty in those pages that I wrote about me and shine that light, that spotlight on myself, so to speak. And that was very, very difficult to do because I did not want to admit to myself and look at the things that I had done and how selfish and dishonest I was and am. And how my self-seeking behavior almost destroyed my life and those around me, like a tornado, constantly in rotation, you know, whirling all the time, whirling. I took a fifth step, and it took me 30 hours to read what I had written, which is a long time to take a fifth. Not as long as others, but that's what it took. And I just read to him what I wrote. And that was my experience doing a fourth step. I took a quiet hour afterwards and looked at that body of work and took the book down off the shelf and prayed, said the seven-step prayer, was ready, I think. Not fully ready, but almost ready to have God remove these things, these defects of character. And the four biggest ones were and are selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and fear. And with that, you know, a lot of these other little ones kind of go with them, and I was able to figure out what was wrong with me. And I, you know, I asked them, you know, I did the deal, like Daniel said, I did the deal. And I think the process of it and the process of the 12 steps is a process around here in AA is something done in stages until you get to the other side or until you have a successful completion. And each step leads to another, and one can't be done out of order. And I think for me in the last 6 years, I did all 12 steps in order, in their entirety, asking God to help guide me through them. When I was writing my fourth, I asked God to write, you know, guide my pen. When another alcoholic that I'm working with today, that's the first thing I tell him to do, is ask God to guide you. That was the best advice I got from my sponsor, Ken. And it's advice that is foolproof and works. If you invite God in, he will solve and help you deal with everything that you need to deal with, all your problems. It's not just about quitting drinking or taking drugs. Now, I never did heroin, but I was Cheech and Chong, and I loved cocaine. But I never really, you know, heard somebody say it. And I have a lot of friends that are heroin addicts. I'm sure there are a lot of people that are IV drug users. And I heard somebody on a little conversation say, you know, and a lot of the young people may relate to this, you know, slam dunk. Slamming, you know, heroin, called it a slam dunk, which is the first time I ever heard anybody use that expression in AA. But I can see that, yeah. I can see you wanting to slam it in, you know. I know how to slam down Budweiser after Budweiser, and my drink of choice is always rum, Captain Morgan's. I love Captain Morgan's rum. Rum and Coke, please. Another. And I loved the bartenders, and I had a lot of friends that were bartenders. Before I was legally able to drink, I had tabs in 7 different bar rooms in South Boston. Not bad for a 17-year-old kid, 18, you know. And I loved being the big shot. And that was part of my alcoholism, the big shot. Some of these things started coming up as I started the journey through the steps. You never know a problem. You have a problem until you admit to having one. Step one again, just to go back to it, because step one is so important here. Admit you're powerless, if you can. And what does admit mean? Acknowledge the truth. Acknowledge the truth. And you may have heard it, and it's a cliche in AA, but if you acknowledge the truth will eventually set you free around here. And that's what happened with me. And it happened when I got up to steps 8 and 9. Reflection, looking back, making a list. Yeah, a lot of harm there, a lot of harm done. And step 8 was reflection and forgiveness. And step 9 was about restitution and making amends. And I did. I started to make my amends. I had a lot of financial amends. I was $400,000 in debt. I owed the government a lot of back taxes. And I'm a gambler, too, and gambling was a big part of my story as an alcoholic. And I mixed and substituted different vices throughout my years in AA, throughout my 20s. I became a gambler. And I learned to play poker when I was 5. And I had a casino. We had a casino and a medical marijuana, one of those. So it was kind of medical marijuana facility in a casino. And my upbringing was a little unorthodox, and it definitely wasn't the Beavers. But when I started to come to in AA or awaken, so to speak, I just realized how much sickness and illness and just malady that I had, maladjusted, how maladjusted I am, and just how deep this disease runs. I could speak, and I've heard people over and over talk about this illness being spiritual and mental and physical, and I could, the doctor's opinion talks about it in the early parts of our big book. And if you haven't read that book, I went 20 years without opening that book in AA, and that is something I truly do not recommend to anybody that may be looking for the solution, because that's where the solution is in the book, the owner's manual, the diary for the first, they say, 100 alcoholics that participating in the writing of that book. And the last 6 years I've read a lot of that book, and I've studied it. And I've done my homework. I've made all my amends. And I can't tell you how that feels to be standing here tonight. I don't owe anybody an apology. I still owe money. The government's still looking for me. Uncle Sam. But I'm not running and hiding from them. And I've written letters. And I did a pretty good bankruptcy with a good attorney. And I was able to discharge well over high $380,000 worth of back taxes. Massachusetts is still looking for me as far as taxes, but I didn't have a license. I didn't have the right to have a bank account when I first got into Pathfinders. My car was repoed, but I was still driving on a dirty license. I was still driving out of spite. No one was going to tell me that I couldn't drive. If you're driving and you don't have a license, be careful. When I was released from Pathfinders, I bought one of those little bicycles that had the lawnmowers on it, and I would putz around from the first place that I moved after I graduated from that treatment recovery home, and I would zip around on a little bicycle that had a motor on it, and I had trouble mixing the oil and the gas. And I only had about a mile to go from where I was living, but eventually that bicycle broke down, and I couldn't mix the oil right. Not a mechanic. I wish I had Daniel there. Maybe Daniel could have fixed it for me. But I bought a Harley not long after that, and I love motorcycles. I always have. All my brothers are Harley guys. My dad rides a Harley, and that dad is still sober today, over 30 years, and I've had a lot of issues with him over a lot of different things, and I finally signed all the peace treaties and made all my amends, and I don't have any resentments. And getting to step 10, discipline, that's the discipline step around here, and daily inventory. Step 10 is continue, and it mentions that right when that step is explained in our big book. Continued to take personal inventory. When we're wrong, promptly admit it. A lot of questions are asked or shown in the big book to ask to take inventory again. Continue to watch for resentment, fear, and dishonesty and self-seeking behaviors. Continue to watch for resentment and fear, because those things crop up all the time. They still do in my life. Sober a number of years, half dozen, six-pack. I got a six-pack again of six-pack. Been sober 6 years. And when I was sober 12 years, I felt like I was sober a day out of my mind. And today I feel recovered. And I owe that to God first, the men that helped me when I first got here, my sponsor who guided me through the 12 steps, who I'll be eternally and forever grateful to. The women that I've met, the men that have put me up in their homes, the men that, and women that have employed me. I had a guy employ me for a few years, teach me a trade, show me the way, take me into his home. I have keys to his house. He stayed at mine. I got to travel to Martha's Vineyard to vacation with him and his family and spend lots of time in recovery related activities, sober dances, conventions. Somebody talked about learning how to scuba dive at the meeting I attended last night. I got a chance to learn how to do that in sobriety. I've run a marathon. I've been all over the world in sobriety. Other countries, I've been to meetings all over the place. AA is worldwide. Trust God, clean house, and help others. I finally trust God. I finally do. It happened maybe a year ago or 2 years ago. I finally trust God. I've definitely cleaned house. I heard an alcoholic say, clean house. If you clean house, God may visit. If you keep it clean, he may stay. That's pretty deep. God is everything, every day. I've had the privilege to help a few other alcoholics, and they've helped me. The last guy that I helped through the steps, the last fifth step that I heard, I helped him with his amends, Sean, and we both went back to Boston, him to make his first amends and me to make my last. Thank you, Sean. I made amends to my daughter, and I'll end with this. I went 6 years without seeing her and not being in her life and being full of fear. Full of fear. And I went home and I made that amend in a little place called Castle Island, which is a section connected to South Boston, where I lived and drank, had many drunken nights. And that little island is a castle. And I made my amends to her and to her mother. And I had no right to be forgiven. I felt like a deadbeat. I felt lower than low. But this little girl, my daughter, it was probably the most spiritual thing I've seen anybody do in my life. She was happy to see me, and she forgave me, and she accepted my amends. And I have a relationship with her today. It's kind of new, and I'm rediscovering how to be a dad. And that's thank you, God. Those are the things that I was so afraid to speak about at AA meeting. The things and the pain that I caused, the damage that I did, these are the things that kept me sick in AA. And these are the things that I need to look at that will get me well. A barroom for an alcoholic is where the hope of a family goes to die. And my good friend said that to me, and that's so true. I'm so grateful to be here. And let me end with my sign. Thank you, God.